Guardian Unlimited.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our first Guardian debate. This is the first of a series of four Guardian debates. I'd like to start by thanking The Guardian, who has sponsored this debate as our partners. We're enormously grateful to them, and we're enormously grateful for you, all of you, for coming to join us to discuss this vital topic. The format of this afternoon is that each of our panellists is going to start, and then we're going to ask you to help us to debate this important subject. But I am just going to run through which of our speakers. Heather Ackroyd, of course, works with Dan Harvey and has made a series of extraordinary pieces, the latest of which can be seen now on the Littleton Tower, Fly Tower of the National Theatre in London. Next to her is Peter Sellers, who's also got a major series of extraordinary work running at the Barbican, New Crowned Hope, which was commissioned by Vienna, the city of Vienna, to celebrate the death of Mozart. And he's also recently opened a new opera, Dr. Atomic, by John Adams at the Holland Festival. On this side, I've got David Aronovich, and I've got a world exclusive, which is that this is the first time in public that we have we can reveal that he's working with Tony Blair on a BBC One series about Tony Blair's years, which is incredibly exciting. And finally, I've got Jonathan Harris, who is Professor of Art History at Liverpool University and is the Director of the New Centre of Architecture and the Visual Arts. So, it's a fantastic panel. It's a wonderful topic. I think we have to mention before we start, of course, that not only has this week been the first week of the first Manchester International Festival, so in our minds it's been an amazing week for art, but it's also been a pretty momentous week in this country for politics, with a new Prime Minister, a new cabinet, a new Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, who comes from this northwest region, and of course some pretty major political events with the major cities, including Manchester, on high alert. So, Jonathan, perhaps I could ask you to start. Thank you.
What I shall argue this afternoon is that great art, that is, artworks above and beyond ordinary works of culture, in any field, certainly do not mix. As part of my case, I will have to offer a particular definition of the idea of mixing, with which you may not be so familiar. In the end, however, I hope to convince you that not only have the greatest artworks never mixed with politics, but that any great art in the future will not either. In history, there are countless examples of ordinary works of culture in every field, arising out of direct involvement with political ideas, political classes, and political power. These have included propagandistic vehicles for political states, ideologies, and parties. Jacques-Louis David's early 19th century portraits of Napoleon Bonaparte are a case in point. So are Leni Riefenstahl's films of Nazi rallies. So are socialist realist paintings of Stalin from the 1930s and the 1940s in the USSR, and patriotic one-nation murals produced at the same time by artists working for the New Deal state in the USA. Other, also ordinary works of culture have been produced to battle against dominant political and social conditions. Michael Moore's documentaries against guns and private healthcare, or Band-Aid's Feed the World song from 1985. George Harrison's song Bangladesh, released in 1971 to raise money for the starving there. Or Neil Young's recent album Living with War, attacking George Bush and the Republicans. Now, a third set of very ordinary and often terrible works of culture, sometimes called mass culture, are cravenly at the service of the politics and appetites supporting consumer capitalism, including violent DVD games and videos, and sadly to say, Shrek 3, which I saw last week. Which is not to say that these products are entirely worthless. All these works of ordinary culture, however, share the feature of having been produced primarily in order to achieve specific political and often consumer capitalist ends. However, they sometimes certainly had other objectives. Michael Moore really tries to make competent documentaries. David unquestionably tried to develop the genre of the portrait painting. George Harrison's Bangladesh song can be clearly related to his other musical interests at the time. Lenny Riefenstahl had a genuine interest in the use of theatrical lighting techniques. However, in all these cases, their use of a particular medium was made subservient to a political situation and political objective. All these works of culture were essentially propagandistic, whatever we might think about the rights or wrongs of any particular political objective. I supported Band Aid's aim of raising money and consciousness of poverty and inequality. This, however, does not make Feed the World a great artwork. Great artworks, in contrast, never arise out of primarily political objectives. This is not to deny, however, that they are always made in situations in which political conditions of one kind or another exist. Great artworks, such as Michelangelo's Medici Chapel wall tombs in Florence, or Henri Matisse's Blue Nude, or the Beatles album Abbey Road, or Francis Truffaut's Jus Légume film, or The Clash's album London Calling, or D.H. Lawrence's novel The Rainbow, were all made in specific historical political moments and refer to these in certain ways. Patronage by the autocratic rulers of Florence in Michelangelo's case, or British society in the late 1970s at the beginning of the Thatcher era for The Clash, or Truffaut's exploration of social and sexual relationships. But this aspect of their production does not define their purpose, or their form, or their value. This is where I have to clarify what I mean by mixing. Great art, in all cases, I believe, actually evokes political situations. This is one of its facets. But this evocation is indirect, tacit, suggestive, and never propagandistic. This political aspect, however, is always held away in great art, and in this quite literal sense, does not and cannot mix with the artwork. Claude Monet's painting Water Lilies, you might think, is an utterly non-political, even anti-political, great artwork, until you know that he painted it with an earshot of the guns of the First World War. Once you know that, it becomes an inescapable aspect of how you experience the painting. Monet chose not to include this political situation. Yet it is evoked, oddly, through the silences and calm of this great abstract painting. The guns, the politics, are held away. Thomas Hardy's novel Tess of the D'Urbervilles involves an account of the human tensions in the development of urban society in England in the 19th century, but cannot be reduced to the political aspects of this situation. His concern was with how different individual voices can be heard through experimentation with the conventions of the novel as a form. What these and all great artworks share, therefore, is an evocation of society and politics, but a deliberate distancing of society and politics as the primary reference. Great artworks evoke politics, allude to it, but move away into the heartlands of their particular aesthetic form, be it a painting, a piece of music, a novel, or a poem. This aesthetic form is never free of reference to politics, to human consciousness, to psychological meanings, but it cannot ever be reduced to these factors involved in its making. Great artworks exhibit a delight in the play of materials, paint, film, words, musical sound. They refer to politics, but these references are indirect, held away, and never the key to the pleasure or meanings that great art produces. In this sense, then, art and politics do not mix, and they never will. Thank you.
So, thank you. There's still time to defect, if you want to the other side. Well, maybe hear what I have to say and then make your mind up. It's almost tempting to redefine the word politics as poly from the root, meaning many, and ticks as blood-sucking creatures. But that would implicate us all as citizens of the state, which isn't perhaps the best way to go about it. And in fact, politics comes from the Greek word polis, which means city or the state. And in ancient Greek, a polites or polites was a citizen of the state. And politikos was pertaining to issues of the citizen or issues of the state. The word slipped into Latin as politicus, and it meant pretty much the same. And then via the French politique, arrived in England as political around 1420. So really, politics means the process of running the state, and it hasn't changed since ancient Greek. But what do we mean by state? But a state is a political association with effective dominion over a geographic area. It usually includes a set of institutions that claim authority to make rules that govern the people of the society in that territory. Aristotle said, as a speaking citizen, you are inevitably a political citizen. The German economist Max Weber gave a very influential definition of the state. He said, the state is an organization that has a monopoly on the legitimate use of physical force within a given territory. Mark Wallinger opened a piece of work in London in January called State Britain. He meticulously recreated a 40-meter-long display series of panels that surrounded Brian Hoare, who is a peace campaigner and had kept vigil outside the Houses of Parliament since the beginning of the Iraq War. The original display comprised over 600 photographs, postcards, placards, many which have been given and donated by the public to Brian. There were images of dead babies. There was a sign saying, Blair lies, kids die. There was a little white teddy bear saying, Bears Against Bombs. And in the centre of the display, there was a picture of Brian Hoare wearing a T-shirt saying, Blyer. Mark's original display was reduced from 40 metres to 3 metres in 2005 by an act called the Serious Organised Crime and Police Act of 2005. He managed to keep 3 metres. Mark Wallinger employed 15 people for 6 months and spent £90,000 to recreate it in its entirety. It was installed inside the Duveen Hall in Tate Britain. In January 2007, signs at the entrance of the hall warned that the exhibit contains images of extreme human suffering. A few days before the opening, Brian Hoare said he knew nothing about it, but what we had were pieces of art. Now, the root of the word art actually goes back to the Latin ars. And there's actually quite a delightful run in the Oxford Dictionary of arsy to arty words. You can have arsis, arsine, arsmetic, arsitry, arson, arsivarsi. I quite like the idea of being an arsivarsi artist. Arsivarsi actually means to be slightly chaotic, to disturb things, to be slightly chaotic, to be slightly anarchic. And there are some great examples, maybe not great artists, but arsy artists who've done a hell of a lot to provoke confrontation and challenges to certain established systems. For example, Hans Hacker, a German artist, in 1971 was commissioned to make a work for the Guggenheim Museum in New York. And he caused a sensation with a piece called Schapolsky Real Estate. And it was the fruit of months of research into the business activities of a family of New York slum landlords who owned 140 tenements in Harlem and the Lower East Side. The piece was not simply an expose of the activities of one businessman, but about the capitalist free-for-all that allowed such people to operate with impunity. When Hacker tried to show the highly structured installation at the Guggenheim Museum, the Board of Trustees not only refused to allow it in the building, but also fired their own curator. Actions which perversely only proved Hacker's point about complicity and corruption in American society. Now, to add insult to injury, 3 years later, another RC artist, brilliant, who I think is a great artist, the German artist, Joseph Beuys, arrived in an aeroplane. He was wrapped in felt. He was taken by an ambulance to the gallery. His feet never touched American soil. For 3 days, he lived, slept with a coyote. Every day, 50 copies of the New York Wall Street Journal, you know, the one all about stocks and shares, were delivered. The coyote acknowledged this by pissing on it, as probably did Joseph Beuys. At other times, he would gather felt around him, and with his crook, he'd be a shepherd. I mean, the coyote was variously aggressive, even companionable towards the end of it. Joseph's point was that the Native American, the coyote, was their god. It was perceived as a god, with the power to move between the physical and the spiritual world. After the coming of the European settlers, it was seen merely as a pest to be exterminated. Beuys saw the debasement of the coyote as a symbol of the damage done by white man to the American continent and the native cultures. His action was an attempt to heal some of those wounds. Now, for Beuys, he made no separation between life and art. He would never make a separation between politics and art. He knew that creativity is probably the deepest thing we have within our soul and that we answer to. And that's what he wanted to impress. And he was controversial. But he believed, essentially, that the personal was political. Now, this was a mantra taken up by the second wave of feminists. The personal is political. Barbara Kruger worked within the advertising industry. She came out, she did a series of fantastic posters. I shop, therefore I am, in the 1970s. Jenny Holzer did a series of work which she called truisms, where she posted up, you know, kind of little posters all over Manhattan with words like, the abuse of power comes as no surprise. And in your own self-interest, be very tender. Now, I'm going to rip up this little introduction to art and politics, and I'm going to get a little bit more personal. I can't even really go in a shop now when I go shopping for clothes. I actually feel quite sick. I feel sick by the multiplicity of the choice, by the fetish of choice. And in fact, I would really advocate corporate theft. And my sister is a designer in New York, and she frequently sends me little parcels of designer clothes that have a label in saying sample, not for resale. I am very, very angry, but I'm also very, very tender about things, between anger and empathy. I would never describe myself a political artist. Life is too full of nuance and subtleties to do that. In 1977, I did the first course in this country that offered the kind of the post-modern joyful mixing of the bloods. It was almost about hybridization. It was saying, don't separate visual arts, don't separate dance, don't separate drama, bring them into the melange, you know, play with it. Very, very playful, very, very joyful. Whilst I was mingling the bloods, my boyfriend, who was inspired by Joseph Beuys's work, was sleeping in the pig pen. Said quite a lot about our relationship. And in 1977, punk had unleashed its dirty wings on the world. Within 6 months, it had been sort of captured and taken into the marketplace. But over in Germany, Joseph Beuys was setting up the German Green Party with Petra Kelly. Now, the German Green Party is the most influential and the strongest political environmental force that we have in the world today. And that's because Joseph Beuys was so committed to having some impact into the political sphere of events. He didn't want to make a separation. He was a shaman. He believed in a shaman's approach. He was fascinated by myth, by cultures, by totemic creatures. In a way, we have a lot that we have to give a big degree of recognition for. In 2000, the German Green Party passed a piece of legislation called the Nuclear Exit Act. They are committed to decommissioning all of their 19 nuclear power stations. And they no longer want to use nuclear power for any civil energy supply. Now, in this country now, we're in a very, very difficult predicament, because our government want to bring back nuclear. And I will get very, very, very personal on this level, because I lost my thyroid in about 1999 because it was cancerous. When I asked my oncologist why this very, very, why I had this very, very rare form of cancer, she said that the incidence had quadrupled in the last decade, and that the expert opinion was pointing to the fact that contamination from the radioactive iodine from Chernobyl was causing a massive increase within it. Now, I'm fine, but I'm not fine about bringing nuclear back into this country, and I'll use my imagination and my wit and my sense of celebration, my sense of party to fight it. Thank you.
I was so taken up with listening to those two that I forgot to think about what I was going to say next, because I think they were both, in their ways, extraordinarily interesting, and I feel very much the outsider at this particular discussion. Neither of the two artists, I mean, Wallinger I've heard of, that Heather referred to, it I ever heard of before. But I think what this discussion is really about, from our side, from the side of the proposition, is not really about whether art in any way reflects upon or raises political issues or situates itself in the real world. And actually, I thought that in her speech, the way she came to it, Heather actually gradually gave the game away. Because she went from a world, she said she believed in nuance and so on, and then deprived her artistic intention of nuance. It was the fact that nuclear power and Chernobyl had caused this thyroid. Highly speculative, possible, but highly speculative. But it was a fact, and it was a fact which needed to be exposed in some kind of way or worked on with artistic intent. In other words, you cannot imagine an artistic intention which was tried to suggest to you that we should have nuclear power in order to deal with global warming. That is an impossible artistic intention. And that's very revealing, because what it really means is that we're not actually talking about whether or not art in some way encompasses politics in some general way, as the way Heather suggested at the beginning. What we're really talking about is whether or not politics should, as was suggested right at the beginning, harness art for itself in order to make some kind of point for itself. That's essentially what we're talking about. We can examine this, the difference between this, possibly simply by looking at the works of Shakespeare. If Shakespeare had written plays largely in the way in which has just been suggested, then, for instance, Hamlet would not have been about Hamlet. It would have been about Claudius. It would have been about what a very bad person Claudius was and how angry we were, this being the operative word. Everybody's got to be angry, no matter how well off they are, no matter how middle class they are, no matter how well healed they are, no matter how well their life is going or that around them, they must be angry. It is the absolute sine qua non of middle class or professional middle class existence these days. We cannot possibly admit at the moment that we are less angry than everybody else is about something, even if there is remarkably little sometimes for us to be angry about. We will find something to be angry about. I think actually in that sense, State Britain was a very, very good example of its kind. I think State Britain was an utterly crass and preposterous installation. It was interesting to me that when Heather introduced it, she introduced it as Brian Hoare started his demonstration at the beginning of the Iraq War. He didn't. He started his demonstration as a protest against sanctions against Iraq. Sanctions that were taken by various governments as a result of a resolution at the United Nations in order to seek compliance from Saddam Hussein following the first Gulf War. Sanctions supported by, amongst others, Robin Cook, the then Foreign Secretary, and later, as being the way in which we had successfully, in his terms, contained Saddam Hussein. Now, it is very interesting, in a way, that you think, Heather, that he started his demonstration when he did, because what you have done is removed any possible ambivalence. Here's an ambivalence you could have built into that artistic statement. The ambivalence is that there are, of course, now no sanctions against Iraq. In other words, you could build in the ambivalence for Brian Hoare, beware of what you wish for. because it may not be given to you in the way you want. But that is not a permissible ambivalence. And in fact, you will find no such ambivalence within Wallinger's own state, Britain. There is no ambivalence in it. It is very much as Heather described her intention towards nuclear power. It tells you exactly what to think. It deploys itself without ambivalence in the service of a particular idea. It obliterates the idea of a contrary idea. In fact, it doesn't even represent the possibility of a contrary idea. What about, we may ask, are there any pictures of anybody killed by Saddam Hussein in that? Of course not. Now, Wallinger himself declared that his intention in that was not to draw attention so much to the issue of Iraq, although he's been slightly contradictory about this, and about the issue of the banning of the demonstration or the removal of the installation, Hawes threw it 40 metres down to 3 metres. I have to say that as a previous president of the NUS, I had assumed, because we were always told, that actually you couldn't demonstrate within that part of area of Parliament anyway. So it came as quite a shock to me to discover that they had misled us over all these years, cue another installation, possibly, and that we had been obediently obeying the law when in fact we could have taken them all to court and marched straight through the House, through the area of the House of Commons. Brian Hawes' demonstration was taken down from 40 metres to 3 metres. If you go past Parliament, he is still there. In fact, there are now currently something like 10 tents on Parliament Green. Nobody else, incidentally, has attempted to demonstrate using that degree of space in that kind of an area. It is the best known, the most publicised, the most tolerated large-scale demonstration outside a major government building that I can think of anywhere in the Western world, even at 3 metres. And yet we treat this thing as if it was somehow the consequence of, or the victim of, a vicious series of state impositions. In other words, we treat it as the absolute and exact inverse of what it is. But that's not even my argument. My argument is that no other conclusion is possible. No other conclusion. There are many conclusions that are possible in Shakespeare plays about what you think about various aspects of politics. It is full of ambivalence, which is why we can discuss it even now. There is no ambivalence in this, even the ambivalence that should be there. And it ends up with the fact that there is a line through the Tate which is supposed to be the 1 kilometre mark from Parliament, where the installation, where you're not supposed to, but actually, it isn't the 1 kilometre mark. It's outside the 1 kilometre mark. None of the Tate actually falls within the so-called designated or banned area at all. Now, if you knew that, that could be some form of ambivalence. But since you won't find that anywhere in the catalogue, even that ambivalence is effectively denied to you. Why? Because actually, when we talk about these sorts of policies, I mean, can you imagine, for instance, getting into the cage with a coyote and pissing on a copy of Socialist Worker? Something that I would be gladly happy to do. Very happy to. But can you imagine any artist actually doing it? It wouldn't happen, and so on. So what we tend to be talking about is orthodoxies sold as transgression. There isn't a transgression. This is the safest form of protest you can do anywhere. Now, of course, if you go and do it in China, that really is transgressive. If you do it in Tiananmen Square, that is highly transgressive. If Brian Hall were to take one placard, let alone 3 metres of placard, telling Hu Jintao to piss off, or peeing on a copy of the People's Daily, that would be very, very highly transgressive indeed. And indeed, it wouldn't last for very long. And there may be, but you can't. So actually, the actual fact of this whole demonstration and the whole installation is that if you think about it for 5 minutes with a kind of open eye, it proves the precise and exact opposite of what it's supposed to prove. But nobody, from the Tate management to any of the artists, to any of the people who reviewed it, actually noticed this obvious point. So, you may say, well, actually, that goes to show the very fact that I can say this now here now means we can go and look at it with a different eye and so on. But you know what the intention was. As I said, orthodoxy dressed up as transgression. Where are the great pieces of work, or the substantial and edgy and provocative pieces of work that deal with areas that we need to be provoked about, like our incredibly ambivalent attitudes towards childhood sexuality? Where are they? Where have we seen them? There were a few around before, but where are they now? I don't see them. I really don't see them very much. If you want to pick who the people who, in my experience, are the most mendacious, the most powerful and the most under-satirized group presently at work in British society, you would pick television commissioning editors, without a doubt. Do you know why they're not? Why are there no programmes on television pointing out to you the absolute absurdity of the lies, the distortions, the incredible self, the pomposity, the self-regard of the people who commission our television? Because they commission it. And nobody's prepared to write it. Where are the Alistair Beatons when it comes to this sort of particular group of huge cultural nawabs and nabobs? Where is the art about them? It's nowhere. It doesn't exist. Or about our own attitudes on the whole. It doesn't exist either. I'm not entirely surprised about that, because we like to have the suggestion, and this is what I think increasingly is happening at the moment, when people are talking about political art, they're increasingly talking about something that gives them the illusion, the delusion of an attack on power from a position of absolute and total safety. So what we now tend to call political art is actually something else. It's not only not great art, it's actually corrupt art. And I'd like to end with just a tiny example, because I thought it really summed it up for me. There was an exhibition at the ICA on Iraq, on art about Iraq. The ICA had asked artists to envisage something which was appropriate to the 4 years of occupation in Iraq. And there was one of the reviewers, a guy called James Molyneux, a socialist reviewer and so on. I saw this on his website just yesterday, but it just kind of struck me. He points out things like the first piece we encounter is Nate Sloman's installation never-ending story consisting of old broken petrol pumps. This establishes from the start the central role of oil. I mean, that's about as subtle as a house brick over the back of your head and so on. But it also, more subtly, evokes the history of the US's oil and car economy. It's a very different use of the word subtle to the one that I'm used to. But what is interesting about this, is that you see is that this chap, Molyneux, also says, Jalal Tufik's dual-use memorial highlights the extreme intellectual isolation of Iraq through sanctions, a rarely mentioned aspect of the conflict worth remembering in the context of debates about boycotting Israel. The Socialist Worker, the paper of the Socialist Workers' Party, major force in the Stop the War movement and the campaign and so on, Socialist Workers' Party believes in the boycotting of Israel. Molyneux's review, as he said on his site, an edited version of this appears in Socialist Worker. The bit that is taken out is the bit debating the question of the boycott of Israel. This is an edited for politics arts review of a political exhibition in a political magazine where they claim all the transgression but make absolutely sure that nobody understands the full extent of their orthodoxy.
What an enjoyable afternoon.
Of course, art itself is resistant to binaries, and therefore the pro and against approach to this very debate is an irritation, because art is about living inside the contradiction. Art is about dealing with the tension between two poles. Art is, in fact, neither a one or a zero, but comes alive somewhere between. That place you characterized beautifully as ambivalence, but I think it goes to some deeper place. That's not just ambivalent. It's a place that's beyond your public self, that reaches very deep into your private self, and then, with any luck and some courage, could re-energize, reanimate, and deepen your public self. And art is the negotiation between selves, who you would like to be and who you are, who you imagine yourself to be, and yet what your actions actually are day after day. Art is a space that does not yet exist. and that's why we're so hungry for it. It's a category that is beyond categories. It's a label that is beyond the labels. I don't here want to go into bad art. There's plenty of it. Or bad politics. There's even more of that. But I want to talk about ideals because, in fact, art exists to remind us that ideals are possible and that ideals are always in front of us, always something that we're moving towards. His definition of an image is two or more distant realities that are made to touch each other or meet. The French word is rapprochement. This bringing together, this reconciliation of things that we think are contradictory or impossible that they coexist. But art is in fact the invitation to move past the ideology of this must die so that that can live. And in fact, invite us into a world of radical inclusiveness, where the skill, the social and political skill that we're desperately in need of honing and deepening is the skill of inclusiveness. And the aspiration of democracy is not about eliminating one of them, but actually creating a structure that can contain both or more. The Greeks not only giving us the word politics, but in fact they created the theater as an institution of democracy, because it was, of course, understood that in the Senate anybody could stand up and say any dreadful thing, and that in the theater you're held to a higher standard. As you know, the Greek democracy, which lasted for approximately 12 and a half minutes before money and fascism took over again, what was marvelous is, you know, if you were, as they say, a white male, you were a citizen. And then if you were a woman, a child, a slave, or a foreigner, you had no public voice. It's not an accident that the name of every Greek play is the name of a woman, a child, a slave, or a foreigner. That the Greek theater was a giant listening space, a giant ear carved in the side of a mountain, in which every citizen, everyone who voted, needed to attend. And if you couldn't afford it, the city council bought your ticket. But there was a place for every voting individual, because it was understood that an uninformed democracy is worse than a tyranny. And we need to get another level of information in order to be citizens. And that is an information that we can only get through dance, poetry, and music. That the deepest issues in front of us, in fact, can't just be handled through legal or political processes. The only way you can move through that issue is culturally. And that issue is how people see other people. Do they see them as human or not? Partially human. When we're talking about the humanization of the world and what the humanities are about, it's about according full human status to a human being. And sometimes that requires Sophocles or Virginia Woolf. And that is an enormous political act. We need to ask these questions in a larger context, to ask what our values are that go beyond profit. And right now we're in a period where profit is the only value, and therefore it's rendered most of society valueless, emptied society of its value, emptied public space of value, emptied the public sector of value, replaced it with profit. And the resulting crisis of values is expressed in crime, is expressed in total disregard of public space from a wide range of citizens. And therefore, a giant investment in enforcement, incarceration, and violent public sphere is created. My proposal today is not, of course,
art is propaganda. We've been there. Art is not telling you what to think, it's just insisting that you think. And also that you feel. Get outside your head for 1 second as well. Think and feel across the generations. Art is about causes and consequences. Art is about where did this come from? What are the roots of this? And where is this going? What is the long-term trajectory? Both things that tend to be occluded in the heat of the day-to-day political fight. Art is not going to make you buy a new brand of toothpaste tomorrow morning. Art is not about advertising. It's not convincing anybody of anything. It's actually empowering people to hear the sound of their own voices. And at its best, when it's provocative, it insists that you talk about this with someone around you. And you break the wall of your own silence, and you find yourself in a real conversation. That is a profound political act. Now we're into a phase, and I'm happy the word orthodoxy has been brought up, where the political orthodoxies on all sides are so repellent, and where elected democracies are so in defiance openly of their electorates. In my country, the last 60 to 70% of the population are on record as opposing the Iraq War. In our last election, both presidential candidates supported the Iraq War. Who are we voting for? I mean, it's a crisis of democracy which has ceased to represent anything but money and special interests. And therefore, democracy does need to be reimagined, reconstructed, deepened again at the roots. And the orthodoxies are such that most things are off limits for discussion. Right now, the task is to open the blocked lines of communication and create an artistic space that gives everyone permission to move beyond and outside of their own orthodoxies and discover, rediscover, and reaffirm shared space. Let's start with some basic things, because right now it looks like a long, hard century of war. What is the alternative? The alternative is to deepen people's listening capacities and deepen people's looking capacities. To learn to listen more deeply and look more deeply, and then finally, to begin to imagine a set of structures that can begin to shape and build a democratic ideal where multiple voices, multiple points of view can coexist, interact in a dynamic that is creative, alive, engaged, in which the energy that normally gets channeled into violence is transmuted. I think in field after field, we look and we see what is urgently needed are creative solutions, because the places we've been are not adequate to the century that we are now living in. This sense of the creative alternative is what the world desperately needs at this moment. And we need a new generation of artists who are mobilized with the sophistication, deep sense of responsibility, and deep sense of humility to take this on. As a working artist, I can't use the word greatness when I go to bed at night or when I wake up in the morning. You're just trying every day to respond to three simple words. Will this help? And one of the ways that we can help, and that politics is in desperate need of at this moment, is not that this is the end of the discussion, but to create, turn the page, and start a place where another discussion can begin. a discussion that can be open-ended. And again, that can acknowledge the histories, the complicated, subtle voices that we're inheriting. Because complexity is not something to be frightened of. And it's why we need a generation of art that complexifies exactly at a moment when we have a generation of politicians that simplify. This living with complexity, skillfully, with intelligence, with insight. And finally, and let's face it, with pleasure. Because the world is going to be transformed through pleasure, not through accusations. That alluring sense of what is the world you actually want to live in. Let's redirect ourselves. We've had enough oppositional thinking. What we now need is to move toward a shared space of pleasure and fulfillment. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. That's four remarkable contributions. So it's follow that. I'm going to ask audience members, please, to make a contribution. So can I ask you to stick up your hands?
Madam Chairman, I am actually not certain about the motion we are debating. Are we debating? Do art and politics mix, or should art and politics mix? Now, the two sentences were pronounced within the introduction and created complete confusion straight from the beginning. Because I think that the two are quite different. If they're not, would somebody in the panel enlighten me on that?
Thank you very much. There was a gentleman back here.
I've got a specific question for Jonathan. Two, actually, and that is to define what he meant by these are great works and these are not. And the other thing is, do you see a difference between propagandist art and political art? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Two very good questions. Thank you. And finally here.
A tiny question. Chopin, art or politics?
Thank you very much. I should just, in the spirit of plugs, say that the answer for that one is probably playing at the Museum of Science and Industry. It's called The Pianist. But having abused my position in the chair, may I now ask which panellists would like to start off? We've got a range of fantastically interesting topics to pick up on. Jonathan, maybe I can ask you. Thank you.
By great, I didn't mean to infer that works have to be old or have, you know, a long tradition of being valued. I meant works that are powerful, that are enriching, that question, that interrogate. It's a subjective definition. I'm not saying it's an objective canon. I never suggested that. Yes, there is a difference between propagandizing art and political art. I wasn't saying that art which doesn't try to be political is better, necessarily, either. It's a necessary but not sufficient condition, I think, that art does not try to be propagandistic in order to be great. Does that make sense as a distinction? So there are lots of artists who are inspired and involved politically who are not producing directly propagandizing art of the socialist realist kind. Jenny Holzer was mentioned, or Joseph Beuys. The category is extensive when you get to the 20th century, and avant-garde visual art in particular. In fact, it's almost hard to find anyone who isn't, in some sense, trying to be political. And that brings with it problems and baggage of its own, I think, need to be addressed.
Sorry, I'd like David to come in next, sorry.
It's not a complete answer to... It's just some kind of musing, because I desperately want to live in Peter's world. Especially a world in which people seek to bring me pleasure and fulfilment. I could do with a bit of both.
But there's something, this kind of high-grade Pollyanna-ishness about what you're saying, and I'll try to illustrate why. In the first place, one of the things that we looked at, what somebody mentioned earlier, was violent videos. They are, for the people who use them, pleasurable. It seems to me, you know, the notion that violence is an aberration, is aberrative, is kind of, in fact, going through all your contribution, and actually it's very much so for your side of the debate, if we want to talk about sides a bit, because I don't think that the two of us have done it quite so much, but I take your point about how we should mix it, is actually a kind of notion, is an idea that we don't really mean politics, we mean mixing, with a very, very clear ideological position which emerges at each and every stage about how the world is. Take your assertion, for instance, that profit is the only value these days. With whom is profit the only value? If you were to take any of these people with whom you think profit was the only values and go back with them to their homes and see them amongst their children or something, or their children amongst them, their profit would not be the only value. It's a bit like your feeling, Heather, stood there, you know, in this agony of terrible choice in a clothes shop, a feeling, incidentally, that men have had for generations. You know, all the agony, but none of the choice. and so on. It's like that feeling. It is this kind of notion that somehow or other, those other people, or many other people, don't live the good life, and that we know what the good life is. And here it is, kind of encapsulated. Both of you have suggested that politicians are essentially rascals. But one of the points that you were making earlier, Peter, about immigration, it seems to have, I mean, it's far more nuanced. The immigration bill that has just been gone down in America was something that united the Bush administration and Senator Edward Kennedy for the rights of immigrants from amnesty, and united against them sections of the right wing of the Republican Party and many so-called left-wing Democrats who wanted to see some form of protectionism. Now, I wait yet now for the deliberative art form, in a way, which encapsulates the complexity of that debate and shows you, in a sense, how to frame it. I don't think it exists. And what you've both done, I think, is you've actually, in the way in which you've sort of involved yourself in politics, you have effectively said art is superior to politics. That's effectively what you said. I've got a problem with it. It's not true. It isn't true. Art is not superior to politics. Politics and art are both absolutely essential factors, and those who are practitioners in politics can be, in their sense, I mean, you asked the question, and this is where I end it, because I've answered too long. Chopin, did you say, art or politics? All right, I'll get back to you. Tony Blair, art or politics?
Heather, do you want to say a word, and then we'll go back to the audience?
Just the one word, very carefully positioned. Politicians are rascals. Well, I think the art world has been full of quite a few enfants terribles in the last decade as well. In fact, they have made their names on their hijinks and their attitudes. So I think the rascal element works between both areas, politics and artists. I wouldn't say one above the other. Are artists superior? I think it would be very interesting to have an artist in residence in the Houses of Parliament.
Or a politician in residence at the Tate.
Absolutely. I think it could be a very, very interesting cross-collaboration.
I think there's a vote for that one. I'm going to ask for another round of questions and comments, please. Brief questions and comments from the audience. There's someone here, and then there's someone else right behind.
I just want to take issue with David Aronovich's description of Peter Sellers as a high-grade Pollyanna. I work in Northern Ireland, and what happened there was that many artists created many kinds of spaces, from community artists through to high artists, created many kinds of spaces for reflection and imagination that did move the debate forward in Northern Ireland. So that's not high-grade Pollyannaing. That's the truth. Yeah.
I have to come to you, Peter, next on that. I'm sorry, I have to.
In fact, And I really am not, David, trying to be Pollyannish. I'm literally talking about a place where people don't have to kill each other, and that in a place like Cambodia, in a place like the Congo, in a place like Chad, in a place like Paraguay. And I invite people to come to the Barbican over the next 6 weeks, where we will present work by artists from those countries, art that really is seeking a place where history can move forward, a place on the other side of the mass graves that acknowledges the mass graves. In fact, what will the ceremonies for the dead be in our period, where the disappeared are reappearing everywhere, and where none of the perpetrators will come forward? What lament will be large enough for the number of people that will die in Africa this week? I'm sorry. To me, there is a missing part of this picture. And art is going to be one of the only things that can get us through it. But it has to be better art than most of what we've got now. And all I'm saying this morning is trying to put out a challenge and acknowledge from my own point of view the challenge of being alive at this moment in history. What we're really calling upon, all of us, is different life choices. That is a cultural question. Living differently. That is a political question. It's a cultural question. It is a personal question. To me, those are essential questions, and this is not art as a leisure option. What we're asking for is not more art, less politics. What we're asking is for equilibrium. Equilibrium that was destroyed one generation ago when politics and money had the priority of public action. And we now need to bring education, culture, the other parts of the whole human being back into the picture on an equal basis. And they have to return to the table better informed, more responsible, more committed, and obviously, the adorable part of David, with more fun.
I just wanted to pick up on what Peter was saying. How do you quantify that our suffering is greater now than it was, you know, at the beginning of the century or the last century? And it just brought to mind a comment that the composer John Cage made when he went to see a friend of his performance. And his friend had written a little post note to the performance saying, "I hope that in some way my music goes to making the world a better place." And after the show, after the concert, he said to John, did you like it? And John said, "Yeah, I liked it, but I hated what you wrote." And he said, "Well, what do you mean?" He goes, don't you think there's too much suffering in the world?" And John Cage said, "There's just the right amount." Now, you can either look at that and think that's cool zen and it's very calculated and it's very hard. Or you ask, how do we really and truly quantify suffering? I don't know how to do it. Not the only way, but what we have to negotiate through, people don't want doom and gloom. They don't want to be cast out, you know, with their little pill of cynicism about how horrible things are. People want to be engaged. They want to embrace things. They want to share insights. And that's where creativity comes into it. So even though climate change is a big problem, the people that I gravitate towards are architects, writers, philosophers, other artists, you know, scientists, environmentalists. They're there. They're really, really happening. And they're very, very lively. And they are engaging. And I would still say that the thrust of their engagement is ultimately creative.
Thank you. Okay. David, I'm going to give you the last word, David, if I may.
Thanks very much. I should make one point absolutely clear to those people who sort of tax the panel with the possible inconsistency of the motion.
we really have nothing to do with the formation of the motion. Okay, absolutely nothing to do. Which is why some of us had to spend some time kind of trying to redefine it for you. Because if I was to take the motion exactly as it's written on the page, I'd vote against it as well. Because it would be impossible. I accept Jonathan's version of the motion, and that's the thing that I... And if you accept that version of the motion, then that's, in a sense, what we'd invite you to vote against. But it's been very... It's really been... Very, very interesting. I mean, so much more, actually, much more interesting than I expected it to be, to be absolutely honest. So we admit, you know, that all these things kind of mix up and they all come together. But I think what I return to at the end is what Keats famously said. Remember, he said, "We hate poetry that has a palpable design upon us." That's the problem. I think, actually, what we've seen a little bit from the two proposers, opponents of the motion, is that they do actually have palpable designs upon us. Because I have to say, there are some kind of people's notions of art, as suggested through what they've said their politics are, which I simply, when they say it, I just think, I'm with Keats here. I am tired of things that have a palpable design upon me.
None of us here have, of course, gone into detail because you're speaking in very quick strokes about what the real process is that we do engage in as artists. And I would really emphasize, for me, the issue is exactly, and I will repeat, not to tell people what to think, but to create the conditions in which thought is possible. And also, what I'm trying to propose, and it may have been too subtle, is a different set of artistic structures that we have not yet seen. We really need very seriously to ask ourselves what this could mean, the question of multiple voices, and the question of structures for multiple voices, and again, the question of opening questions, and really having a response come back that is rich, participatory, engaged, and moves us all to the next chapter.
For me, it's not possible, of course, that we're going to leave the room with answers. But I think we have had a lot of fantastic illuminations this afternoon. I'll never look at the water lilies again, actually, by Monet, without thinking about those guns that he could hear. Peter, I always have so many of your sayings in so many of my notebooks over the decades. For me today, art is seeking a place where history can move forward. Is something that will track me through the next few weeks of this festival as we explore our urgent stories. And I'd like to end with Heather, if I may. I think the use of the word embrace, which you use a lot, is terribly important for all of us, because that is another way in which the artist leads us and leads us into a new sort of discourse, and one that, as you say, is tender rather than angry. Can I just finally thank The Guardian again and just remind you all that we can continue this debate. Please do. I think that there's a lot to reflect upon and a lot to carry on thinking about. It's been a fantastic afternoon. Thank you very much.
Guardian Unlimited.